Where's our song? Our song's not playing. Every day I'm there's the backup. Sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Further from sobriety. So sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. And now, in another stunning display of professionalism, it's time for Homegrown, your only show dedicated to local art with your hosts, David Von Strawn and Leslie M. Scott Jones. Now, here's David.
Hello! Charlottesville! It is Sunday! It is 10 o'clock.
You asked for it.
And if you are just tuning in, and if you didn't know, you better ask somebody. You are listening to Homegrown 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I am David Von Strawn, a.k.a. the Devious One, a.k.a. Nefarious Rucker, a.k.a. Negro Suave, a.k.a. Black Frodo. Little guy, hairy feet, trying to get through the darkness.
You're trying to get through the darkness!
Hashtag Trump's America. They're not that hairy. I've actually been working on them with the sugar scrub that the lovely, the loquacious, the lascivious Leslie M. Scott Jones prescribed for me.
Yes,
she knows how to work herself.
Well, you know, because I care about you, and I didn't want you to walk around with slave feet.
I appreciate you.
I wanted you to fix that.
Slave feet affect 65 to 70% of African-American males.
But there
to
is
present
a cure.
Day. There is a cure.
There is a cure.
There are some rusty heels out there. I have been in the gym locker rooms of Charlottesville. I see you, brother. There is a cure.
There is a cure. Please.
Run, Toby, run.
I can't. I got slave feet. What you gonna do about slave feet? Chuck scrub. Scrubbing your heels.
Oh, wow. Ooh.
A little bit.
Yeah, maybe the coffee didn't really that. Clear that up. There you go.
We're working on it.
All right.
It's early. We ain't got no time for this. We have a jam-packed studio.
We do.
In the back, as you can see. Oh, my God. It
There's
is full up in here.
There's
up in here. It's about to get a little musty, actually. You know. Brother ain't take a shower. You just got up early.
Oh, my God.
So,
why did you tell people
I'm
that?
I'm just saying.
Why
I'm
do we
saying,
need to know that?
I'm just saying. I'm just We're personal
gonna,
and we're warm here.
A little
all right,
to Annie.
So let's just.
Now that you've given that information,
I'm just playing. I took a shower yesterday.
God.
I love seeing it. Irene Mathieu is in the house.
Hi.
She's awesome, as well as Annie Kim.
Hey.
And we also have. They are poets. They're doing a joint poetry reading at the New Dominion Bookshop, June 28th. Thank you for coming in to our Jam Pack studio, being part of this. How are y'all?
We're good. Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you for being here. So I did some homework. I read up on a little bit of y'all's poetry.
I did.
I actually prepared before the show. Crazy, huh? Looked up on some people, Googled some things. Yours was a little harder to come by, poetry-wise. So I was like, oh, this one. Both of y'all are, highly published in, various publications on web and in print. First of all, how does it feel to just be a poet and, have your poetry in a book, That's got to be dope. Because I have a lot of poetry in my books, but I don't have poetry in a book. So talk about that. Poetry in books. That's dope.
Well, it's funny because my book came out a couple of years ago, and I picked it up for the first time in about a year today. And I was like, oh, my God, there are poems in this book. Thing, right?
Do you not just pick it up because it's my book and what's in it and blah, blah, blah.
I'm not that egotistical, but I pulled up the last poem. I forgot I wrote this poem. I literally forgot.
Do you want to read something
cool.
for us?
I can, but this one's sort of a downer. So
you got to read something, too, Irene.
Yeah, yeah.
You got to read something, too. Poetry off. Bam!
Oh, my God.
I'm sorry. I always make everything a competition when two people are in the...
Yeah. Yeah. Too much reality television. First, can you talk about... Do you guys think, for both of you, do you have a particular form or genre of poems? Because looking at your poems, there's a lot of variety. How would you describe your poems, the poems that you write?
So I would say I don't have a particular form or genre, or that maybe I use a lot of different forms and genres. So I don't have an academic background in poetry, so I feel sometimes like a little bit of an imposter in that I can't sit there and write you a beautiful sonnet. But it's more of an organic process for me, so I kind of let the poem dictate the form that it needs to be in. And in that sense, I'm not sure there's a name for all of the types of forms that I use. But yeah, having your poems in a book is super weird, because I've always been a journaler. I've always written ever since I was a kid. And my first chapbook, which is a small collection, came out in 2014. And every time it's just like this very bizarre experience that there's this material thing that has my name on it that other people can go and buy and basically like be inside my head.
Right, yeah.
It's a little weird.
And get you to sign.
Right. Yeah.
Sign your head for me so I can take it home.
Can that be an album name? Sign your head.
Yeah.
Can that please be somebody's album?
It is now.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's like a sucker ball.
But correct me if I'm wrong, you're a licensed pediatrician.
I am.
Yes. Yeah. And that was your field before you started writing poetry, or kind of like simultaneously?
I would say I was a poet first. Well, I wasn't a published poet first, but I've been writing since I was a little kid, long before I knew I wanted to be a doctor.
Absolutely.
And my first chapbook came out when I was in med school still. Mm-hmm. So they kind of evolved simultaneously, but I guess poetry came a little bit first. But yeah, I'm a pediatrician.
What I've noticed from like primarily your poem, Labor Day, and this is kind of like patternistic in all of your poems. Of course, everything's from an observational standpoint, but I just imagine you like in a lawn chair all the time, just like as a wallflower, like watching like suburbanite functions and just kind of like smirking at yourself, like sipping your drink. Like, I gotta put this in the book. This is some wild stuff right here.
Just low key judging everybody,
right.
You know.
But in a healthy, like objective sense, like talk about that.
I mean, on my Myers Briggs, I'm an ENFJ, so I admit I'm a little bit judgy. I'm not gonna lie. But I feel
it's all right.
Like thank you.
It's all right.
But you get it out somehow. You get it out.
Well, I feel like as a doctor, you know, my training is to make an assessment of something. So I kind of have to be judgy, and I have to have this clinical objective assessment of an observation. And I think that includes myself, too. And this book is a lot about my family. Like, no one escapes the judgment. So, I mean, that's kind of accurate, except I'm very rarely actually sitting in a lawn chair because I feel like I'm always running around. But I guess in my head, I'm in that lawn chair of my mind, just, like, observing things.
That's not bad at all.
Annie, talk about your style.
My style. I think every poem is just its own Annie poem, kind of like what Aren said. So right now I'm kind of doing long, messy things. And I've been doing long, messy things for the last, I don't know, year or two. So it's kind of like whatever I'm thinking about that I don't understand, that's kind of getting at me. Mm-hmm. And like Aren, I write a lot of family poems too. Mm-hmm. So they're almost like essays, the stuff that I'm writing right now.
I've noticed that yours is more long form. Yours is more paragraphed and stuff like that. There are stanzas, but thick, thick blocks.
So I'm interested.
Thick, juicy blocks.
Oh, I like
words.
That juicy blocks.
Yes.
Yeah. So sometimes I try to mix up some prose in there too, and it's just kind of whatever is on my mind. The poems in my first book are a little bit like that, so it sort of depends on what's catching my mood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, let's hear it. Let's hear it. Who wants to go first? Should I flip a coin? Rock, paper, scissors. Annie's reaching for the book, so she's going to be bold. She's going to go first.
I have some shorter stuff that I can read, but I don't know if you want
to. Go right ahead.
I'll go for it. Okay, so let's get a poem that's not in this book. It's kind of sort of a love poem, but it's in a series of poems in my current manuscript about Eros or love. So this one, actually, I steal a line from a poet that I really like, named Frank Bidart at the end. So the last line is not mine.
Is this Eros of Contagion?
So Eros the Contagion is not the one I'm reading, but it's in that series. Yeah,
gotcha.
That one's on my website. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, this one's called Breaking Up with Eros. Okay. This morning, for example, I miss your heat, how you flare my skin into a sun, whipping my cold, dead planets into orbit. To slip beyond the body's gate, glide through its chain link fence. I need to find something beyond just the physical. I've had enough from column A. Proof you're more Apollo, less Saturn devouring his sun. Mostly I want to be done with you. Take a match to my fingers, grip the shiny toilet with both hands, heave. Then it's night again. I'm out, walking back after dinner. The air is soft as chalk on heavy paper. My pores are open, ears open. I feel the bricks of the courthouse crumbling, smell the ivy crawling across them, bittersweet. It's you I want again, your monstrous light knocking my stained glass window. Black ink of you, raining swift down, parched map of me, blurring all my capitals. That, at least, was irreparable.
Mm. Wow. That was like every one of my nights during the 2000s. How did you know?
Well, I Googled you.
It's me walking home.
Yeah.
Like, I'm done with you. Set me up to knock me down. All right, Iran, what you got?
So can we talk about her poem a little bit? So can you talk about what form that, you know, how that poem found the form that it found?
Yeah, that's a great question. The answer is I don't know. I mean, I do a lot of drafts, but sometimes when I'm really struggling, I write in couplets, which just means stanzas of two lines each. There's something about that that helps me.
Some of your poems have got this epigrammic nature to them. At points.
I think that might be a leftover from being a lawyer. So I practiced law for 12 years. And so trying to get my thinking mind on and to match with my emotional mind is kind of a big challenge for me. But something like I like to do.
So for your poetry, what's the balance between it is something on the page, something to be seen, something to be read, and something to be visually read, and something to be heard, something in the air, something to be vocalized?
That's a great question. So sometimes it's a little bit from column A, a little from column B, because some poems I like to space out because I want people to take time and think time has passed in this poem. So the long, messy poems I'm talking about like having white space all around them. And in an actual reading, I probably wouldn't spend like half a second or, you know, half a minute pausing, but I want the reader to pause and feel it, let it sink in. A poem like this is a little bit more musical to me, and it plays to how I like to think about the line and have it be a way to break up that time. So I think I kind of engage both with the ear, and I think about the musical aspects of it. And I have a musical background, but it doesn't really translate to this necessarily. And then there are ones that are more like, oh, let's just be crazy and go on the page.
I've never said how somebody has musical background and it doesn't translate to poetry.
Well, it does.
Doesn't matter right here.
But not really like one-to-one.
Got you. Iren?
Sure. So, as I said, Grand Marinage is mostly about family history, so just a tiny bit of background. My family's from New Orleans, and so what is typically called Creole New Orleans. And so there's a lot of different folks in my family. People look all different ways, which is very typical, not only across the American South, but Latin America, lots of places that are were colonies. And so this poem is called A Foolish Controversy Over the Color of the Skin, and that title is taken from Rodolphe de Dunes, who is a New Orleans Creole historian from the turn of the last century, and that was a phrase he used with respect to the idea of racialization. And the only other thing you need to know is that passing is the phenomenon of people of color who are very light-skinned, basically leaving their families and sort of passing into white society to gain those privileges. So this is a little riff on that. A Foolish Controversy Over the Color of the Skin. A woman passing as a pecan, a woman breaking open a pecan and passing as its beige meat, a woman passing as a fig tree's bark, a woman passing as a fig, a woman passing as swamp water after rain, and a man passing as a pinewood floor, a man passing as a piano, his voice passing as honey-colored notes floating above a crowd of masked revelers, a man passing as cypress, a man passing as the prow of a ship run aground, a man passing as a bowl of clabber or a bowl of molasses. Have you ever heard of such a country where a woman passes for an oak banister and a man passes for a leather-bound Bible or a book of law? What you see here is a true phenomenon. A man is disguised as a shoe in need of polishing, and a woman is burnished and heavy as a worn saddle. Little boys and girls are made of dried sassafras, nutmeg, burnt flour, and clam shells. Hold one of our small, round babies in your hands and see how it turns into a chicken's egg before your eyes.
Pow. Talk about the mind state that you were in writing that.
I think I was really interested in the phrase of foolish controversy, and I was trying to sort of take the idea of foolishness and run with it and create something a little bit absurd and a little bit surreal and use that to sort of show how the racialization of people is so absurd and makes zero sense. Mm-hmm. And it's not logical. And
right. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what this book is about is how much that is context specific in terms of place, where you are in the world and time, mm-hmm. where you are in history. And so I think I just wanted to, in a hopefully a beautiful way, illustrate the absurdity of that by creating this very like multi-layered metaphor.
Right.
And what I recall of writing that poem is I was just kind of on a roll once I started. I was like, what if it's this? What if it's that?
Yeah,
and what else
yeah.
could people look like? And then how could these different objects in the poem, like a book of law or a Bible, mm-hmm. also be some of the material culture that that we use to invoke the naturalness of the, our ideas mm-hmm. about race or the implications of them?
Mm-hmm. And usually in poetry of race relations by people of color, myself included, and I'll, you know, take the heat for this, is like it can tend to come off as a little intense and mm-hmm. angry, but I noticed that with this one is more like curious and absurd, because, you know, racism is absolutely absurd when you get down to it. To judge somebody by your color of the skin is absolutely insane and, you know, stupid by mm-hmm. for lack of better words. But yeah, you just come at it with a certain sense of curiosity, and also when you use objects, it tends to exemplify the objectification
mm-hmm.
of people of color.
Yeah.
And their and colorism in general. So I just thought that was really clever and wise, and if that was purposeful, amazing. If not, that's cool too.
Take credit.
Take it.
No, that's what I love about sharing poetry, is because I honestly didn't think of that, and I love when people like draw those connections and come up with other things that I didn't see. So mm-hmm. that's awesome.
Can you talk about the role of repetition in your poems? Because
mm-hmm.
I feel like I feel it and I see it a lot, or in the little that I've read.
Yeah, I think that's part a little bit of a musical thing. Some of it is about sound and about sort of almost imagining a chorus that's repeating. And some of it is about emphasis. And I try to be sparing with repetition because I think that it can become too much. But I think when it's deployed wisely and sparingly, it can create this musical quality and also can really drive a point home.
And I want to throw the same question to you, because I love asking this question of poets, because it's always the question that I want to know when I'm reading poems. Again, balance between your poetry as something to be seen, something to be read, and your poetry something to be heard, something to have read to you or mm-hmm. to have yourself read aloud.
I think I start my writing process with thinking about poems on the page, but part of my editing is always to read the poem out loud, to experiment with it in the air, being read to other people. So it's kind of a multi-step process, but I would say it starts with me thinking about it just on the page and, you know, potentially in a book or in a publication, and then it kind of evolves to something that's more interactive and performative.
Is rhyme played out? Like, do poets rhyme anymore? Because, I've just noticed this heavy emphasis on prose and experience mm-hmm. and... I was just raised as a poet to rhyme and to figure out that scheme. I guess I don't know. I was just
and also you're big into hip hop, which is so much about
right,
rhyme.
Yeah. Right.
Much so. So it's like
I was just talking to a new colleague about that actually, and I think that rhyme is just inherently pleasurable. So I don't think we ever want to get rid of rhyme in our poetry, even if we're not formal old school rhyming poets.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that I have a lot of half rhyme, so it's sort of like sneaky rhyme. Mm-hmm. It's not always like night to night, light, bright, but sometimes it's a little bit of that, mm-hmm. or maybe it's not at the end of a line to make mm-hmm. it super obvious, but I like that repetition, and it's kind of like
say,
having a refrain.
Yeah, some internal rhyme sometimes.
Yeah, so it just kind of sneaks up, but I think you're right. It is hard to feel like you're a serious poet these days mm-hmm. if you rhyme a lot, mm-hmm. which is kind of a shame, mm-hmm. but there are rhyming poets out there.
Right on.
Yeah.
Right on.
I totally agree. I think I use more internal rhyme and slant rhymes and stuff because I think for me that's a natural part of the process of writing poetry, because in your head it's different from having a conversation. That's the difference, I think, between prose and poetry. There's an element of musicality, and so I think that necessarily involves rhyme as well as alliteration and lots of other devices that, whether you like it or not, I think if I have my poetry hat on, that's gonna be how I express things.
Comments? Say, very y'all cool. are amazing.
Thank you.
Leslie, I've kind of been taking it up. You got any thoughts on the matter? We got a minute and a half.
So,
got a minute?
I have a minute. Okay. So, Iren, when you're writing, especially this book that has a lot about family and family history, I'm also a writer, and you know, when you're friends or family member with a writer, you're eventually going to end up in something they do.
Yep. Yes.
It's just gonna happen. Yeah. Just be, you know, prepared. So I'm wondering what your family and friends, like, did they recognize themselves in there? Did they say anything to you? Were they pleased? Were they upset? Like, how did that conversation happen? Because I know how it happened for me.
Well, okay, so this book is highly based on mostly my paternal grandmother's stories. She's 96. And I interviewed her sort of informally over the course of a couple years, and I told her, I'm writing this book about you. And then when I had this draft done, I sent it to her and I was like, is this okay? And she said, yeah, it's cool. I wouldn't change anything. And so I was like, all right, if she gave me permission, you know what? She's the matriarch. I'm good. Mm. Like, there may be other people who appear in this, but
she put the blessing on it.
Was her approval. But I mean, you know, I think people just, like, at this point, my parents, my family understand that's what I do. Sometimes my mom will hear a poem about her and she's like, what? You wrote a poem about me? I'm like, yeah, you birthed a poet. Like, this is your own fault.
Yeah.
You can't
be mad.
Yeah. Yes.
Mic drop. We got to go. We got to go on that. Iren Mathieu and E. Kim, joint poetry reading at the New Dominion Bookshop June 28th. You heard it right here. They're amazing. So check them out. Check them out. Grab their books. What's your book called?
Grand Marinage.
Grand Marinage.
Mm-hmm. Into the Cyclorama.
Into the Cyclorama. They out. Amazon, Audible, go get them.
New Dominion.
Yeah, of course, New Dominion. Support your local bookshop. Jesus Christ, what am I saying? All right, we got to go. Homegrown, drop!
Hi, my name is Kelly Vandilla. I am the assistant director on Death of a Salesman at Live Arts in Charlottesville. And this is Homegrown, your show about local art. 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
24 minutes past the hour. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Homegrown, 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Jenny Wales is in the house. Yep, that's you. I know, right?
Yes.
You're at Homegrown.
I'm here. Yeah. I'm thrilled to be here.
There's sometimes
it's
yelling.
It's a little jarring. Really at you. We apologize regularly.
No, it's just when you hear your name with such gusto.
Hashtag sorry, not sorry. She is the director of UVA Heritage Theater Festival, which is going down June 27th through August 11th. Oh, summer long. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Right
it's
here,
great
right now.
To be here.
Awesome. Awesome. So, Heritage Theater Festival, big in UVA, kind of a running thing.
It is.
Year number
45.
Wow.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. Wow. It really is crazy. Since 1974. So, is the 45th season of producing professional theater.
So, what's in the season?
So before we get to that, may I ask a general question?
Of course.
Heritage Theater. 45 years?
45 years.
Is it what it was? That is to say, like, when I first got here, Heritage Theater, the idea was that's where you see the American classics. Is that what today's Heritage Theater is?
That's a great question. So I actually became artistic director. It's been almost 2 years. I moved in late July of 2017 to Charlottesville. And it's been a journey to kind of understand what heritage has meant to the community and taking my own experience, my own artistry, my own connections and building connections with the community to see where do we want to move and go? What work do we want to explore? How do we want to shift? Change is always a really tricky word, I think, because people inherently sometimes can get a little worked up about the idea of change. But I think what is important is, can we find Can we find multiple entry points for multiple different members of our community to find a space to see the work at Heritage? So it's not solely classics. It's new work. Last year we did a newer piece that a lot of people may not have totally known. This year we're doing a piece that premiered 2 years ago. So, you know, it's kind of finding that mix between what we know to be the American canon. And I think we're also in a moment in the American theater where we're all reinvestigating what the American canon is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really important moment. And I think we have the opportunity to intentionally investigate. And not only in our programming, but it's what's really important to me is in the artists that we're hiring, the directors, the designers, the technicians, mm-hmm. the actors. Are we creating a company that is reflective of the society that we live in?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of work to do with that, I will say. I'm saying that. But that's part of the whole journey.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing about theater as a mm-hmm. as a form of performance art necessarily. I mean, I remember I've said this before, is like one difference between performance arts and non-performing arts is that our history has to be alive. Like, you know, our pieces don't just sit in museums. We do our history. We perform our history. So necessarily we've got to be in this position of like looking at and saying, does this still work or does this still speak to us? Or because if we don't do it, it's gone.
Yes.
Well, and also if we don't ask that question, because I think through history you get a different answer to that question, yes. right? You know, something that hit an audience in, you know, 1975 might hit an audience, but it might hit an audience completely differently in 2019. And it's so it's kind of like, okay, what is in here that still resonates? And how is it going to resonate? And is that something that we actually want to say?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so I think that's where really the combination of programming and artists attached to projects becomes so important, because you want to ensure that you're attaching artists that are going to be looking at the material in the where we are now,
right.
as opposed to something just being a, we're going to do... insert the name of show just as you've always seen it. I mean, sometimes there's a place for that as well. I think that's kind of what we're trying to do at Heritage, is to provide multiple entry points mm-hmm. and hopefully move us along. I mean, one of my major dreams is to get to a place where we can really be involved in developing new work as well, so that not only are we producing the shows we're producing, but perhaps we're saying to a playwright, what do you need for a week?
Yeah.
We're going to give you a room. We're going to give you actors. What do you need? And so that we're starting to cultivate and build relationships with our community members and outside artists to really have the germination of the, hopefully, ideally, the new American canon as it's continuing to evolve through the work we're doing.
May I say, that's really new for Heritage, because my experience with Heritage has been, and I think a lot of people's experience, like Heritage, or at least certain parts of Heritage, was a place that you could go to see stuff done the way it was done somewhere else. Like, you could, it was, you were guaranteed that, and that was part of, I think, what it sold itself as.
And I think that still does exist. I mean, we open with a show called Million Dollar Quartet, which is a rock musical. It's one night where Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, Carl Perkins, and Elvis Presley found themselves, it was based on a real life event where they found themselves in Memphis at Sun Studios. And that is, it's really fun. It's an evening of joy, and it is what it is. We're not reinvestigating it. We're not, you know, I mean, this is an incredibly, it's a new production from ground up. We're building it, but it's not, it's presented as it was written. But then after that, we're doing a new adaptation of Pride and Prejudice, which is in fact not at all what one would think our idea of Pride and Prejudice is. Hmm. So it's a completely turning on our head, this idea of what we think something is, and then it's flipped. Yes. So it's a and then Steel Magnolias, it's going to be Steel Magnolias. Mm. We're not, you know, it's the set is not like inside a hairdryer, like it's actually we're doing that show.
But you could do that.
We could.
You could do that. You could make the dryer.
We could make the dryer. Wouldn't that be cool?
That would actually be
if you just
really
like
cool.
conceptually like the whole thing just took place within a hairdryer.
It would have to be like that 1960s hair dryer that kind of looked like, like really like retro and freaky with the like the one at my grandmother's hairdresser was always like lime green.
Yes.
It was like that horrible lime green that was in every bathroom in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we're closing out our season with a piece called The Niceties that is tackles race and power in academia. And I think that really at the heart of the piece is this idea of it transcends, it happens in a professor's office on a college campus, but I think at the root of what the piece is how are we listening to each other right now? Mm-hmm. I feel, personally, I can only speak for myself, we're in a moment sometimes where we're not actually listening to one another, and what happens when we're not listening.
I'm sorry, what were you saying?
Yeah, so... But it just feels that way in the media sometimes. It feels that we're kind of in this place where we're in camps and we're not, we kind of are getting in our place and we're so, even if we're having similar ideas about things, we're just not listening.
Oh yeah, it's all about winning the argument. It's not about solving the problem.
It's
all like, I won that point. It's like, okay, and?
Yes.
Like, the problem still exists. Like, what are you doing?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think that's ultimately what the play is wrestling with, is this idea of the reality of race and power in academia, and how do we contend and talk about that, and then what are we going to do about it to solve the problem? So I think having that piece on a college campus to have conversations that will not always be smooth is okay, and part of the reason why what we do as in the theater can potentially move us closer together in our shared humanity. I hope.
Yeah.
I remember a time when Chris Allen and Winston Hodges were right here in the studio, and we were talking about doing comedy during, you know, the Trump era and the Me Too movement and the height of hypervigilance and cultural sensitivity in this world. And it's like, And they said, you know, in a nutshell, that it makes you a better comedian. Do you feel that being a director in a time of hypervigilance and cultural sensitivity and people begging, demanding equity and involvement, do you think it makes you, and that challenge makes you a better director and makes you better at what you do in choosing plays and choosing casting and choosing directors and all of in this whole aspect of overlooking this entire project?
It's a great question, and I think a complicated question, because I think the moment that we're in is so overdue in the American theater that
preach.
When I hear you kind of put it on, you know, like, does it make you a better, I kind of feel like we're so beyond.
In your opinion.
Thinking about that.
In my opinion, like, you know, this is something that in the American theater, these conversations should have been, they're happening now.
Right.
And they're happening now, which is great. Mm-hmm. And there's intentionality in ensuring that we're hiring, you know, and programming in a way. And I think the more that work is programmed and produced, it actually reflects the world that we live in. Mm-hmm. We all are deeper humans as a result of that. But it's a tricky thing, because it's like, because people are, when you say, you know, nay demanding that this occurs, it's, I also want to be clear that I think that we're overdue from everything being a reactionary moment of, oh, okay, well, that's the demand, so we're going to make sure that happens, opposed to really, honestly, developing relationships and building a season with intentionality, which is long overdue in the American theater, to really think about who's writing the pieces you're putting on stage, who's directing the pieces you're putting on stage. Yeah. you know, who's acting in these pieces. Mm-hmm. These are all really, and as I said, I have a lot of work to do, and I have a lot mm-hmm. to learn about this process.
And this is, and I appreciate your ownership and accountability, but that's not what this is about. Let's talk about the season. Can we talk about the season? Because I feel like it's getting heavy for now.
No, absolutely. But I think it's also important. I mean, I do think it's important.
No, you're absolutely right.
I do think
right. And with all that being said, let's talk about the season.
Let's talk about
what's going to go down, because we only got a minute left.
She went through it. Yeah.
See, David, you weren't listening. No, I was listening.
Those were only the four shows. The niceties.
We're only doing four shows.
Oh, I thought y'all had more. See, I was listening. We got the crazy Pride and Prejudice and the regular Million Dollar Quartet, which I'm interested in about. All that. I was here. I was paying attention. Lord Jesus.
Don't forget the Steel Magnolias and the hairdryer.
That's
not
right.
In the
That was big. That was big. I want to see it in a huge dryer. I guess that's all we got. I couldn't end more awkwardly than that.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jenny, really,
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. We going to do dates? All right. Yeah. Heritage Day, June 27th through August 11th. Yeah. Y'all got no excuse. Go. Home. Oh, we going to do a drop?
I thought we were doing a drop.
All right. What? He doesn't have his fingers on the button.
He was so on it at the beginning of the show, and he fell apart at some point.
I don't know what happened. Because it's the pressure.
Stop drinking coffee? Is that what happened? It's the pressure, y'all.
This is Homegrown. Drop.
Hi, this is Priyanka Shetty, and you're listening to Homegrown, your show about local art. 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
Woo. Here you go. 39 minutes past the hour. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Homegrown 94.7. Turning in. Yeah. Because sometimes people are listening in their bed, so they're just like turning. Sometimes I like to turn in my bed when there's a commercial break.
There.
He's there. This guy knows what I'm talking about. 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Weird and proud of it. I love saying this is the show of great names. Nico Scopoliti.
Hello.
The El Presidente.
Thank you so much for pronouncing it correctly.
We went over it like 8 times during the break, so I'm not gonna pat myself on the back for any of that. And Alexa Beal, she is the director of
I'm just joking.
Jefferson Land Chorus in the house. They are going to do a Midnight Summers a cappella concert at the St. Anne Bill.
Read that again.
Jefferson Land Chorus.
No, above.
Alexa Beal.
Amid what?
Like Shakespeare.
A Midsummer Night's.
There we go. Okay.
What did I say?
You said it wrong.
A Midnight Summers.
Oh, my God.
So close.
A Midsummer Night's.
Almost
a cappella concert at the Stab, June 28th. How y'all doing?
We're doing great.
All right.
Great.
Yeah.
How are you?
I'm well from the constant barbs I'm getting from my lovely crew that I love very much.
You got thick skin.
Yeah.
Love you. If we didn't love you, we wouldn't even talk to you.
This is true. So, yeah. A cappella concert. Mm-hmm. That's not done very often anymore.
Yeah, well, we have kind of a unique part of the a cappella market. We do it, I think, a little bit differently than a lot of other genres. But I've only been with the chorus a little over a year now, but I believe
it's not just a cappella. It's
barbershop.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. But I believe it's been a few years since the last Jefferson Land.
Yeah, last time was 2016. Also at Stab. And we are kind of expanding into not just a different genres, but a different approach to the kind of concert that we're putting on.
Hmm.
We've got the world champion female a cappella quartet who's our guest. Yeah. We've got a local, I kind of think of him as a superstar. His name is Jim Winton. And he will be singing a solo. We're actually going to have a pianist playing along with him. So
the acapella thing.
Yeah. So the
thing
we already
Oh, you were just breaking all the rules, my friend. It's gonna be pyrotechnics, man. The dragon in the back, it's gonna be wild.
It's possible. We might be able to work that in.
Next thing you know, you're gonna have somebody doing beatbox behind you.
I've seen it done at some barbershop.
Wave the quartets in the air and wave them like you just don't care.
Sorry.
But
yeah,
right.
It'll be fun. We've got, you know, it'll be a nice mix of, we're doing a lot of different genres. So we've got some doo-wop. We've got some, my quartet, Age to Perfection, will be there. It's my mom and another mother-daughter duo. And we do swing. We do some Sweet Honey in the Rock. We do, so it's we're going for variety here, mm-hmm. something to appeal for everybody. Mm-hmm. So.
So are you fracturing? Are you leaving the identity of the Jefferson Lynn Chorus as being this all-male barbershop group? Because how long has Jefferson Lynn Chorus been going?
50 years.
50 years.
Bunch of
guys, and I'll be straight out. Bunch of usually white guys of a particular age, or even above a particular age, standing and singing and singing barbershop, you know, Goodbye My Coney Island
and
Baby.
Wearing the straw hats.
Wearing the straw hats.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that is the stereotype, and that is the stigma of barbershop, which we are working very hard to leave behind. I mean, what do most people think of? They think of four old guys singing badly.
Yeah.
And striped blazers.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're moving away from that because we're coming into a modern world where there's so much opportunity to sing different styles of music in the barbershop style, which I think, you know, Alexa, you'll do a better job describing than I will. Yeah. But also realizing that there's so much more that we can do with other people, with women. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, wow, what a thought that we might sing with women, or we might be directed by a woman.
Right.
You know, it doesn't have to be so limited, so insular.
Yeah.
And in fact, when you bring in other influences, it just it improves everything you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah.
So Alexa, talk about, so what is barbershop?
Yeah, so barbershop really, to Nico's point, it gets kind of a bad reputation. It has the stigma around the word, but really barbershop just refers to the way that a song is arranged. So it's a style of a cappella, but it really refers to how the voicing and kind of the chord structures that are used. So what it means is that the melody is on the inside of the chord. So meaning that there's a harmony above that voice. So that really is what characterizes the barbershop sound. It's kind of close harmonies, and that melody line is inside. It also has to do with, there are usually use a lot of seventh chords, and kind of rotates around the circle of fifths, and a lot of kind of musical nerd stuff that I won't go too much into, but it's a lot.
Into the weeds. It's okay, because you've got three.
And your seventh modified.
Exactly. But it's a lot of fun. And that chord structure is what kind of characterizes that sound of barbershop. So really, though, any song can be arranged into a barbershop arrangement, right? And have that kind of voicing. So we can do, you know, it lends itself to pop music.
Blowing my mind here. That statement that you just made is blowing my mind. The idea that you would take a barbershop sensibility, this all those sevenths, that close harmony, everything you just said, and say, oh, let's do that with, you know, Miley Cyrus.
Yeah. I've done it. What? I did. Hopped out the plane at LA. I did it in barbershop. Seriously. You can do it. You can do it with anything. And so that's what we're trying to get out in the world, to help people understand that it is more accessible. We can do modern songs. We can just have more fun with it. And it doesn't have to be the four old guys singing the, you know,
you
Coney Island Baby, whatever.
Listen to any of those links I sent you?
I didn't.
She's Out of My Life was the first one that I sent you as a barbershop version of She's Out of My Life, and it's
awesome.
Gorgeous.
Yeah. Four young guys from Sweden sing that one. Mm. That's Ringmasters, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So there's we're not limiting ourselves anymore. I mean, why limit ourselves to a certain gender, to certain demographics, to certain, you know, 1920s music, when there's so much more we can do?
Mm-hmm. It doesn't behoove the craft.
It doesn't.
You know?
And that's why it's been dying. Forward if we don't change something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
I'm sorry, just in my head, like, just I'm imagining this like old school quartet, and then the curtains come down, and then lights, and then the dragon, then Nico comes out on a trapeze actor. Yeah.
We need you on our planning committee for the next show.
I'm so sorry. Oh my god.
Yes.
Here we go.
Barbershop 2019. All right, we're going to play it right now.
I still call your name. She's out of my life. She's out of my life. She's out of my life. Out of my life. And I don't know whether to laugh or cry. I don't know whether to die. And it cuts like a knife. She's out of my do we have the moon? We have the moon. But it was over way too soon. Way too soon. I was so cavalier. Now the way that it stands, that it stands, she's out of my hands, my hands. So I've learned that love's not possession. Love won't wait, no way. Now I've learned love needs expression, but I've learned much too late, too late. She's out of my life,
and now she's
out of my life. Decision and cursed pride. I kept my love for her locked deep inside, and it cuts like a knife. And I cry every night, no matter how hard I try. Tell me why. She's out of my life. My life. She's out of.
So, I have an issue with music that is being, especially popular music, that's being made today, being less complicated, being less less focused on lyric and telling story.
So minimalist, right?
It's like, okay, everyone has had a hit record using this beat or this formula. I'm just going to change a few words and use the same beat and the same formula, and I can make $1 million. So when bringing something like Barbershop that is, as we just heard, so complicated and so intricate and so, and has to be so well thought out and well constructed, how do you meld those two polar opposites?
It's a great, great question. Number one, I think, is we avoid those simple songs to begin with.
So no Cardi B is what you're saying.
No Cardi B, probably, unless. But the other thing that we can do, and we have, there's just so many arrangers out there, barbershop arrangers, who are so talented at taking something that's simple and adding just a whole lot of really cool stuff to it. So we have things in lots of barbershop terms called swipes and all of those things that you heard that made it a little more interesting, the added words, the added, different harmonies that you don't expect. So that's the way that we can kind of beef up a song to make it more interesting. But, I think we always search for the ones that lend themselves to that in the first place rather than. But
is there anything as a director and arranger that you're like, ooh, I really, really, really want to do that?
Oh my gosh, so many. So I will tell you, first off, I'm a ballad girl. So that song right there listened to, I love that one. But I love to, going back to your point, the ones that you can pull the emotion out of. So that's the other thing that I love about Barbershop is we memorize all our music, right? So we're not standing there. We have kind of an interaction with our audience because we don't have the music kind of as a blockade. So we focus a lot on pulling the emotion out of songs and not just trying to stand there and be hokey and fun, but actually trying to be authentic and real and pulling on real emotions. So probably all of those really gooey, delicious ballads with a lot of meaning. Those are the ones that I tend towards.
Sweet Child of Mine.
Yeah. Definitely that one. That would be fun.
That would be awesome.
There's an
eyes that seem to me.
On the other hand, would like to get the older gentleman in our group to do Uptown Funk. I think that would be interesting.
And dress them all as Bieber.
Uptown Funk will give it to you.
Please join our group, David. Please join.
Don't believe me, just watch. Yes.
That would be so much fun.
Sorry, it would be dope.
Yeah,
I would add some love to it.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
We're trying to get away from this.
All right, is that some? How many minutes we got? All right, you sold me. You sold me. June 28th,
going up
St. Anne's Belfield School.
I have one more question.
Yeah, go for it. Oh, cards.
So if someone, perchance, would like to join your choir, how do they do that?
All they got to do is show up on Monday night. 7 p.m. at University Baptist Church is where we rehearse. If you go to our website and send me an email, let me know in advance. We'll open the door for you. I'd love to have you. There are no barriers.
There are
no barriers of entry. Now, if you we do have certain standards of performance and of entry. If you can hold a note.
That helps.
Without a bucket, yes.
JLChorus.com is our website.
Org.
So, sorry, .org. I messed up. JLChorus.org.
Cool. Yeah. Well, that I think that does it. I think we can wrap it up and, try to get out of here a little bit early before we're not getting pushed all around. Nico Scopolici, Alexa Bell, thank you so much. Alexa Beal.
Thank you.
No, I got lazy. I threw away the last line. And I always do that in Shakespeare especially, and I need to watch that. Shout out to Boomy Patterson. Homegrown, packed full of guests. Wanna thank Urin Mathieu, Annie Kim, Jenny Wales, Nico Scopoliti, Alexa Beal, and everybody that took part today in this jam-packed show. I love you, Leslie.
Love you too.
I love you, Clinton. We'll be back next week. Stay tuned for awesome programming here all the time. 94.7 WPVC. Thank you. Peace.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Yeah, those are just...
You've been listening to Homegrown, your only show dedicated to local art. I'd like to thank our guests, of course. Irene Mathieu, Annie Kim, Jenny Wales from Heritage Theater Festival, and of course, Nico Scopoliti and Alexa Beale from Jefferson Land Chorus. Our opening music is from Spit It Out, Inc. It's so much wonderful barbershop for our event music. Any complaint? We didn't do events this week. It was a packed show. Come hit us again next week. Any complaints about Homegrown should be directed to our attorneys at the fine Lisping law firm of Tochterman, Overman, Munson, and Burke. Legal services that wrap around you like a thong. If you are an artist and want to be on Homegrown, we'd love to have you. Come contact us at homegrown947@gmail.com. That's homegrown947@gmail.com. We'll see you next week. Peace.
Contact the show on Facebook by searching Homegrown Charlottesville. Be sure to tune in again next Sunday at 10 for Homegrown, only on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.